Orlando, the Quest Center for Integrative Health will be offering a series of grief, trauma, and remembrance services to the wider local community free of charge. Quest is a nonprofit community-based health center that has served the LGBTQ community since 1989. That's tonight and tomorrow night. Quest Center staff will be available to provide community-based services with the intention of providing a humble start to the mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual healing. If you'd like more information, contact 503-231-5203. Or you can go online to quest-center.org.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, Rob Spillman, is the editor and co-founder of Tin House Magazine, executive editor of Tin House Books, and co-founder of the Tin House Summer Writers Workshop. Tin House was the recipient of the 2015 Firecracker Award for General Excellence and has been honored frequently in Best American Stories, Best American Essays, Best American Poetry, O. Henry Prize Stories, and the Pushcart Prize Anthology. Rob Spillman himself was the 2015 recipient of the Penn Nora Magid Award for Editing, as well as the 2015 inaugural Vita Award from Vita Women in Literary Arts. And Rob Spillman's writing has appeared in Book Forum, The Boston Review, The New York Times Book Review, Rolling Stone, Spin, Sports Illustrated, Time, Vanity Fair, Vogue, among other magazines, newspapers, and essay collections. He writes the Read Politic column for Guernica magazine, is the editor of Gods and Soldiers, the Penguin Anthology of Contemporary African Writing, and is on the board of the Community of Literary Magazines and Small Presses, the Brooklyn Book Festival Literary Council, Narrative 4, and is the chair of Penn's Membership Committee. But Rob Spillman is here today to talk about his first book, All Tomorrow's Parties, a memoir, 10 years in the making, which has received starred reviews from Booklist, Publishers Weekly, and Kirkus, and early praise from writing luminaries Anthony Doerr, Nick Flynn, and Rachel Kushner. Kirkus says All Tomorrow's Parties is a coming-of-age story couched in a travel narrative, one that deftly evokes one of the major historical moments of the 20th century, a richly detailed and always engaging memoir on artistic discovery. And Anthony Doerr adds that if you've ever been young, in love, and desperate to live an authentic life, this book is for you, a ravishing memoir about a young man's quest for art, meaning, and a place to call home. Welcome to Between the Covers, Rob Spillman.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a real honor to be here.
So All Tomorrow's Parties is composed of two intertwining narratives, both I think you could consider travel narratives in a sense, and both involve searching for identity, one taking place during your childhood and another as a young married adult. Let's start with your childhood, partly because growing up in Cold War Berlin with your dad kind of feels like a golden age that casts a shadow over a lot of the rest of the book. So tell us why your family was in Berlin and what it felt like.
My parents are classical musicians, and they went over there on Fulbright scholarships after going to music school. And at the time, and it's still this way, Germany is a much better place for beginning musicians, especially classical musicians. There are, you know, small opera halls and music, you know, outlets all over Europe, and particularly in Germany. So it was a good place to launch their careers. And Berlin was particularly cheap because it was at the epicenter of the Cold War. And it was this cultural mecca at the same time. Because of the post-war treaty, it made Berlin a neutral city, so that if you were a resident of Berlin and you were German, you didn't have to serve in the army. So a lot of liberal Germans moved there as well, and it was cheap, and so it created this sort of kind of artistic foment. So it was a really exciting place to be, even though it was 200 miles inside of communist territory.
That's a really weird thing to imagine, that island of liberal.
Yeah.
Liberal artistic expression there.
Yeah, it was a very weird mix of, you know, there was a huge U.S. Army presence, but there was also all this kind of liberal craziness because there were these giant loft spaces that were very cheap. and expat musicians from all over the world, and artists, visual artists, were there as well. So,
can you speak a little bit about when your parents split and you're living with your dad, and mm-hmm. what life was like with him in the opera, and you living in Berlin with
your
dad? Yeah,
my parents, I have no memories of my parents together. They split when I was very young, and my mother went back to the U.S., and I stayed with my father, who is gay. So I kind of grew up backstage in the gay opera world of Berlin, you know, both backstage and on stage. I was in a lot of kids' roles because I was around and I could sing and, you know, I was available, and it was fun. It was fun. So I liken it to sort of being like Eloise in the Plaza, but, you know, if the Plaza was mostly gay and filled with like opera stars, you know, and opera people. So it did not prepare me well for the rest of the world. But at the time, I thought it was really fabulous. You know, I'm also an only child, so I had nothing to compare it to.
It felt like you were treated in a lot of ways like a young adult, even when you were a kid. Like you had a lot of freedom to be with adults in this art world, even from a young age.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, with that, I just had to behave. I had to be basically, you know, invisible or act like an adult. Yeah. So I didn't really particularly have a childhood.
I do love the scene in All Tomorrow's Parties when you go to East Berlin with your dad and you're smuggling currency over so that you can buy things at a better exchange rate.
Yeah, that was because they never searched kids. So, and you were forced to exchange your money one for one. But if you smuggled it in, you could then, you know, use it. And these Germans loved Western currency.
One of the really early on scenes that adds a lot of narrative heft to your memoir is when your parents split, but then sort of inexplicably to you, you have to move to America to live with your mom. And it doesn't seem like you really grasp the why of that at the time. But you also realize really quickly that you can't speak the language of people your age, in particularly American people your age.
Yeah.
And I would love for you to just touch on that a little bit, because it feels like in a way that Berlin becomes a sigil for you, like the sign you're not American, you're not German, and being a Berliner is actually something quite distinct.
Yeah. That's well put, because when I came to the U.S., I hadn't watched any U.S. TV, and that was kind of the lingua franca of my peers. And so I didn't know what Charlie's Angels was, or the Mod Squad, or, you know, I Love Lucy. So, or even, you know, Scooby-Doo cartoons. Like, I had nothing. And so I didn't know what people were talking about.
Yeah.
You know? And
but you kind of had to know.
And I had to know, because that's what people were talking about. So I started watching reruns obsessively. Like, I would, you know, whenever I could, I would watch reruns just to try to figure out what the hell people were talking about. And I just, you know, it took me a while to get up to speed. And also, I had to obsessively watch sports, because that was the other thing, you know, people talked about. And I hadn't watched any baseball or football. I'd only watched soccer. So I was culturally illiterate, even though, you know, both my parents are American, and I didn't speak with any kind of accent. So I looked and, you know, walked and talked like a normal American, but I didn't know what anybody was talking about.
Yeah. And it feels like Berlin becomes this really interesting metonym or symbol in the book, in the sense that you have you and America not feeling American, your parents on different continents. You have this divided city that you feel connected to that's mm-hmm. also an island within a country.
Right.
It almost feels like you're that island here, there in America.
Absolutely. And I, you know, it became, the older I got, the more I grasped onto it as my true home. And, you know, I'm really a Berliner, you know, even though it was myth-making, you know, I was, you know, building it up. It was my search for home, and I put a lot of weight into Berlin.
So if we flash forward to the other thread of All Tomorrow's Parties, you're in your 20s, mm-hmm. you're in New York with your wife, Alyssa Chappelle, and mm-hmm. you have a pretty good life, it sounds like, going on, but here Berlin sort of disrupts it after you've been in America for a long time. So perhaps could you paint the picture of your life pre the siren call of Berlin?
Right.
And then how that sort of unsettled what you were doing.
Yeah, I moved to New York with no idea how publishing works, but just sort of these sort of romantic notions of having read about the Beats and, you know, Patti Smith and, you know, all these people were living really large in New York, and that's what I wanted. And I lucked into a few things when I moved there. Mainly, I fell in love when I was 21 and got married when I was 23 and moved to the East Village. And because we were the only couple that anyone knew, we were kind of a center of a group of friends, because we were literally the only couple. And when people moved to New York, they would sleep on our sofa. And since we were right in the center of the East Village, Sonic Youth, the band, lived right around the corner from us. And so we would run into them and say, hey, where are you playing tonight? And they'd be like, oh, CBGB's. Great. All right, we're there. And so we would see them all the time and all the other bands in the neighborhood. And so it was just like a very vibrant scene. But I also, I sort of chafed at it. I really didn't think, you know, it felt dead to me. I felt I had these sort of mythic, you know, ideas that I would like walk into the Cedar Tavern and get in a fist fight over aesthetics with like Frank O'Hara. You know, I just had this.
And that wasn't happening.
Yeah. You know, that was a different era. And, you know, I also had this, you know, this, what I couldn't get my head around was like all my heroes had created their own scenes. They hadn't like walked into a scene and been adopted by it. They and their friends made the scene. So I kept putting this, like, you know, I kept having Berlin in the back of my head. And then when the wall came down, I thought this was a sign,
yeah.
You know, a cosmic sign that, you know, I'm not meant to be in New York, but I actually really need to step into this void that is Berlin right after the wall came down.
And how was that negotiation in your marriage when you're like, okay, our life's going well, but it's just not, there's something, you know, that I can't quite describe that's missing here.
Yeah, we were kind of young and foolish at the time. And Elisa trusted me, bless her, that you know, things would be okay if we, and that we could come back, that we weren't abandoning everything. But she'd made a real leap of faith. And for her, she had grown up with a very stable, loving family. You know, the kind of the opposite of mine. She grew up in one place outside of Wilmington, Delaware, with incredibly great parents. I love her parents. They're fabulous people, and her sister is fabulous. I mean, I was always on edge around her family because I didn't understand what a normal nuclear family was at first. You know, they were really, you know, like, when's the shoe gonna drop? But it never did. So she was actually open to adventure from a different perspective. Like, because she had had so much stability, she was willing to go with it.
One of the really delightful things in the memoir, I think, is how you imagine what these other inspiring artists or writers did and use that as motivation yourself. And I wondered if that came from having a dad like your dad. How many writers, I don't know any other writers or editors who have a father who lived for their art, who would do everything based on that and based on passion, not based on what's best in terms of being secure with your finances or what's best and most reasonable stable, which seems like that must have been a model for perhaps looking at these other models.
Absolutely. I mean, my father was incredibly, he's still alive. He's still playing music. Sorry about that. He's still, you know, very much living for his art. He just turned 80 and he, you know, he's off to Texas to judge a piano competition. But, you know, as a young kid, it was really romantic to watch him just, you know, age 40, you know, sleeping on a futon and doing exactly what he wanted to do.
Yeah.
You know, like, he didn't consider what he did work at all.
And right.
When he was teaching, you know, 16-hour days, he loved it. He could just keep going. You know, so that was definitely a model for me. And I think I also, my parents did not communicate after they divorced. They just sort of handed me back and forth. And they both, I think, sort of overcompensated for the other one, how they thought the other one was parenting. So my father was even more lenient than he thought he needed to be. And my mother was kind of more strict and rule abiding
yeah.
than she needed to be because she
they were imagining the
they were imagining how the other one was parenting yeah. basically. So
well, before you read from All Tomorrow's Parties, maybe you can set up what Berlin was like when you went back. So here we're talking about the wall going down, but Germany is not unified yet. So it's this weird limbo period. What was that period like?
So yeah, it was a very unique historical bubble because when the wall came down in the fall of 89, what happened was that quickly the two countries agreed to unify, but it wasn't set until the fall of 1990. And the Western authorities didn't have authority to come over yet. So they couldn't police the east side. And in the east, a lot of the police had basically run away from their posts because they weren't being paid anymore because the East German government had run out of money. So there was this power vacuum that was happening. And in that power vacuum, a lot of anarchists moved in and took over abandoned buildings and painted the buildings pink and flew anarchist flags out of them. And then skinheads would come in from the north, and these were a lot of laid off factory workers because the factories were shut down, and they would try to firebomb the skinheads. And so a lot of Westerners stayed away from this because it just wasn't wasn't safe. So Westerners stayed away, and also the large Turkish population of the West also didn't come in. Because in the West Berlin, there are Turkish kebab stands everywhere and things like that. None of that moved into the East until unification. So it was this very chaotic scene that we stepped into, and we joined the anarchists on this anarchist block and had a really incredibly cheap apartment.
These strange, not really entrepreneurial moments, but moments where people are like, creating wine bars or restaurants or harvesting free furniture for their apartments out of burnt out buildings.
Yeah. And also the East Germans, because they could go over to the West and buy really cheap furniture from the equivalent of like a Kmart, they would put their old beautiful furniture on the street.
Yeah.
Just to get rid of it because it was like the sign of the old. And so we had...
Your apartment sounded amazing.
Amazing. You know, we had Bauhaus furniture and, you know, fainting couches. And, you know, it was just all just dumped like literally down the block from us. And it was crazy.
Well, could you read us a scene
from
that moment?
Yeah. Why don't I read like right near the beginning where... some kids have invited us to a rave, and we have no idea what a rave is because it's 1990 and we're kind of clueless. And they take us to the sub-basement of an abandoned warehouse. So, was gibt's, I ask, and our guide snorts. He explains in German, which I quickly translate for Elisa, that we are in an old ball-bearing factory. He tells me this as he dances across long, sagging boards stretched between cinder block islands. Our flashlight beams ricochet off the oily water, which has a ferrous, noxious reek, and I picture my foot dissolving in it as if it were sulfuric acid. A faint, far-off beat, a fast, steady thump-thump-thump matches the pulse in my ears. Is there another room to the factory? I call after our guide, repeating the question in English for Elisa. No, no, he replies. The party isn't in here. This is only the passageway. Before I can begin to think about where we are heading, on the other side of the waterlogged basement, a 6-foot-wide hole opens into a dank tunnel. The thump, thump, thump of music is now clear, and up ahead a bright light pulls me forward. Entschuldigung, excuse me, my new friend says, shining his flashlight over my shoulder. I turn around and Elisa catches up to us. She gives me her, what have you gotten me into, look, and I give her my, you agreed to this, look back. I also silently give her what I hope is reassurance, and I think she's on the same page, but I really don't care because we're obviously on the cusp of something weird and quite possibly wonderful. Where are we? I once more ask our guide, who snorts again and moves aside so that we can be the first to step through the hole and into a cavernous space constructed of gray granite blocks, the vaulted ceiling sweeping up a good 100 feet. People are dancing everywhere on piles of paving stones and railroad ties and in the long trench that runs through the center of the giant space. They are dancing to the loud, steady, bass-heavy electronic music, something that sounds like Kraftwerk crossed with Donna Summer. The dancers cast huge shadows from the low, icy white strobe lights ringing the room. Atop a Lincoln Log-like construction of scavenged railroad ties perched two sets of turntables and two young men with black bubble headphones who were bobbing along to the music. "Where are we?" I shout. "Under the wall," our guide yells. "This is an old subway station from before the war, closed off for 40 years. Now we break through and have a rave." "I never want to leave," I say out loud. I think, "I can't believe this. We are literally between countries, under two countries." I close my eyes and let the concussive bass vibrate through my body. I can feel the beat of my heart aligning with the beat of the music. I am dissolving, breaking into a million particles. I am nowhere. I am home.
You've been listening to Rob Spilman read from his memoir, All Tomorrow's Parties. That section's an interesting section because it touches on a recurring motif in the memoir also, where you've expressed a fear in the book around an inner emptiness, even once, I think, wondering whether you had a soul when you were a kid, that you weren't passionate about anything. And yet there was a flip side to that also, which felt like it was part of the same dynamic. But when you're partying under the wall, there's a blissfulness around the lack of location and then the nothingness of the location. You could be anywhere, and also it's nowhere.
Right.
And similarly, there's a scene when you're in school in America, there's a hazing with a spanking gauntlet, and right. You escape and go dive into the ocean, and there's a sense of bliss sort of in self-obliteration.
Right.
So both a pleasure in that and also a sort of ongoing anxiety. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was definitely a theme. You know, I sought to either rebel or to escape, and my escapes were either through reading at first. You know, I started working at a used bookstore in Baltimore, and that just really fed my ability to escape. And that's where I became a real reader. And also through running. I became a long distance runner in high school, and by college I was running 90 miles a week, and I would run into the mountains in Colorado and try to get lost and try to obliterate myself through that. And then also through punk music. I listen to incredibly loud kind of violent music and go to hardcore shows in DC. And it was sort of everything that I was not allowed to be in Baltimore. It was kind of...
And also really different than the opera world at the same time.
Yeah. And, there was this dialectic going on of wanting to express myself and express my rage, but not feeling like I was able to. So these were my, sort of places I channeled it.
Yeah.
And seeking oblivion or escape was what I was after.
And tell us a little bit about the structure of the chapters. You have, at the beginning of each chapter, you have a quote, and you also have a soundtrack song. Mm-hmm. How did that come about, and why did you choose those as the way to sort of orient us?
Well, a lot of the sort of anxiety of the book and my up until I was 25 was feeling, again, like what you said, was that I didn't have any of my own feelings, that I didn't have an authentic self, and I was living through others and through either books or music. And so the soundtrack and the opening quotes are kind of a way of reinforcing that, and maybe also even a way of continuing to hide behind them and fighting against them even as I'm writing the book.
I like them, and I love that I saw that Grove Atlantic made you a tour shirt for your tour.
Yes.
So you're doing your rock tour now.
Absolutely. I just sort of jokingly threw that out to the publicists, and they were like, "No, that's awesome."
Yeah.
They made me a tour t-shirt.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
That's all I've ever wanted.
Yeah. And how did you arrive on the title and using that Velvet Underground song as the title?
Well, music is one of the main obsessions of the book, and one of my obsessions. And I love the Velvet Underground, and I thought that song in some way encapsulated the struggle of the book of living for tomorrow versus living for today.
Yeah,
that sort of sad recognition of that.
Right.
And how that fact. So that's what I grasped onto.
Well, it was interesting looking at other interviews of you in the past. If we ignore the interviews in the last 2 weeks around this book,
right.
Almost all of them close to all of them are about are you as an editorial gatekeeper.
Right.
And we see the same sort of questions come back over and over again. What sort of stories do you look for? What are common mistakes that writers make? A focus on the art and
right.
the object and the creative act and right. and publishing. But here we are now, you on the other side.
Yeah.
And this book took you 10 years to write,
yeah.
which made me wonder, as a writer, what sort of craft challenges you came across that you had to grapple with in finding this book's form.
Yeah, a lot. A lot. You know, one of the problems of, you know, working in publishing and being an editor is I know too much. You know, I know I'm a pretty good self-editor and know what works and what is not working. And so the first 7 years of working on this book, I was just really, I was trying to write it linear and chronologically, and there was just no energy to it. I felt like there was just something wrong. And I mean, it was productive failure in a way, in that I was interrogating myself and my feelings, which is what I was trying to do. But I think I rounded a corner at some point where I really didn't care if it was going to get published or not. Hmm. And I think that was a breakthrough for me, is that working in publishing, you're constantly surrounded by the noise of publishing and books that are coming out, and you can lose sight in the art of things, and that it became much more personal for me, and that I really wanted to interrogate my own feelings about the time and my obsession with Berlin and my obsession of living an authentic life. Those became much more important to me. And so the last 3 years, when I settled on the form of being, the struggle for me was to put Berlin more forward, especially the present tense, you know, 1990 chapters. I wanted them more forward, and I could never figure them out. And then I sort of landed on this alternating form and shifted those scenes into the present tense, which created more energy. And then I found, when I was alternating, that I was able to refer, I was able to mess with time in a way, because I could refer chapter to chapter to things that hadn't even happened yet, or comment on them before they happened and make allusions to them, which I hadn't even thought about.
Well, when we had Lacey M. Johnson on, she talked about writing against chronology, as because it mimics the way our memory works too.
Right.
So if you're not writing in the present moment, even if you're using the present tense, it allows that sort of mind movement.
Right. Which is absolutely. And, you know, as much as I know as an editor, I couldn't learn unless I actually did it.
Right.
You know, that's what it came down to. And then, even then, I loved being edited. I had the greatest time being edited, actually. It was just such an honor and pleasure to have someone take your work seriously.
Yeah.
And especially for personal material, it's really hard for you to figure out what is important and not important. And a big breakthrough for me came when I read Vivian Gornick's The Situation in the Story.
That is really weird, because that's my next question.
Really, that was
I swear to God.
Really? That was a pivotal book for me, because I was just, you know, one of the challenges of memoir is that the goalposts are constantly moving. You know, you wake up every day, you're a different person, you have more knowledge, and you can just keep bringing in more knowledge. And her kind of genius, and the simple genius, is like, you just have to separate, you know, your situation and use fictive tools, and also create a persona.
Right.
You know, even if the persona is you, but it's you at what, where are you fixing the persona? And so for me, it was age 25 and not letting in knowledge after that. And
well, I'll just read my next question, just for fun.
Just so you can, like,
but even though I kind of think you already answered it, but I was going to say that coincidentally, I've been reading that book, The Situation in the Story, and she had mentioned one incident of someone who took a long time to write their memoir, and that it wasn't because they didn't know what they wanted to write about, but it was because they hadn't created the persona, which is both you and not you at the same time, but also sort of hones in the path of inquiry, and everything shapes around a specific, like, act of discovery for that persona.
Yes. And that was absolutely...
I love that book.
That was a light bulb that went off when I read her. Because she's so simple about, you know, it's so simple and clear, articulation of that problem.
But it's like, you read it and you're like, of course.
Yeah.
But it's not that simple at the same time.
And also she uses her own work as to illustrate it is also like, I failed with my first book, but I succeeded in my second.
Right, the book about Egypt where she couldn't find the right voice.
Yeah. And also, you know, what was interesting to me too, once I did that, was like, I was able to winnow away an awful lot. And a metaphor I use is that your narrative has to be like a taut string. You know, everything has to contribute to the tautness of the string going through your book. If it doesn't contribute to the themes of the book, it unfortunately has to go away.
Right.
You know, or if it happens after your, you know, fixed self, you know.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to Rob Spilman about his memoir, All Tomorrow's Parties. Tell us about Coffee and Absinthe, the book that you were working on as a young adult. That never came to be, but right. was your project at some point and for a while.
Yeah, it was my way of, I guess it was like apprentice writing, and it was a way to also channel all of my kind of my split personality in a way, my sort of dreamy escapist side, art for art's sake side, which was absinthe, and then my sort of overdrive, hyper-engaged, revolutionary side, which was coffee. And it was a novel that was embodied by the spirits of coffee and absinthe. So,
and have you looked at it?
I haven't looked at it in like 30 years. I'm really afraid to. I'm really.
But
really,
it still exists.
It's somewhere. Yeah, it's in a box.
It's
somewhere.
Not in the fire.
No. I wouldn't throw it out because I'm really curious to, like, you know.
Yeah.
See how cringeworthy it is.
Yeah.
You know.
What's one of the pressures for the book that I think is really great from the reader perspective is both you and your wife are really dedicated to live the life of artists. But throughout the book, Elisa's, regardless of what adventure you are on, she's in the background, like working hardcore. Mm-hmm. And so she's doing all these adventures, but she's doing it. And there's this background pressure because you're not, and you're doing this sort of internal struggle, wanting to be doing what she's doing, but unable to be.
Yeah.
And with that in the background and you in the foreground, it feels like this coiled spring. That's right.
Yeah. It was funny because I talked a big game at the time, you know, we're going to go live a revolutionary life and be artists and like really do it. And she was actually doing it while I was like, you know,
right.
You know, parading around, you know. I love the Faulkner quote of don't be a writer, be writing. Mm. You know, and she, you know, I was a writer and she was actually writing.
Right.
You know.
Well, and she's a formidable writer and editor in her own right. She co-founded Tin House. She was senior editor at the Paris Review. She's contributing editor at Vanity Fair, has written several critically acclaimed books. Mm. I was curious about her in real life outside of the book with all these skills, but also she's this character.
Right.
And the raw, well, I think in the end, it feels like the book is a love letter to your wife. In any given moment, Rob Spilman, the persona, has varying feelings about what's going on. So I was curious about whether you sought her input, or because of her being, you know, editor, writer, and character, if you had to shield this from her, because that would just kill the whole deal.
That's a good question. No, we show each other all of our work, and when I first showed it to her, she said, "Who is this incredibly boring, flat, lifeless character?"
Really?
That is supposed to be Elisa, you know. And I was like, "Ooh!" And I was trying to shield her in the writing, and she's like, "This is just dead on arrival. Like, you know, like, I would never say any of this. And, you know, she got in there and just hacked it up. And I'm like, okay. So she gave me the permission to actually, you know, write it as it was. And but she kept pushing. She pushed me the entire time.
So that wasn't that wasn't fraught.
It was definitely fraught.
It was fraught.
Because, she can criticize me like no other person. Right. I mean, we've been married 27 years, you know, so so she, like, up until I signed off on final pages in January, she was like, this is a lazy phrase, or this is, you know. Huh.
So she was an editor.
Oh, yeah.
One of the editors.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, because she's very protective. And, you know, it's really easy to write the negative reviews for both of us. You know, like, why didn't this editor edit himself? You know, we're both thinking that. So she's more protective than anyone. Yeah.
Well, there's you do a lot of danger seeking in the memoir, and there's a lot of politically volatile situations, but also the car crashes and a variety of other things that happen in the book. But when you were interviewed by Penn and they asked you what's the most daring thing you've written, you said this memoir. And part of that was around, I think, writing about people you love and people close to you, and that it was intense to show this to your parents, for instance. Can you talk a little bit about
that? Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I speak in public all the time. I do festivals all the time, but I'm usually out there promoting other people's work. I'm not usually talking about my own work. And this is, you know, just really, it's exposing, you know. Yeah. So, and that's just not how I usually am, you know. So it was hard to, and also hard to be honest. And it's just not a family thing. So it was difficult. And then very difficult showing my parents. I was very worried about how they would react. And my father came back first, and he said, "Oh wow, you made art out of your experience. That's great."
You know, wow, that must have felt great.
Yeah,
to hear
it was, and you know, he had some corrections and some fact checking things, and some like, "Did I really do that?" And I was like, "Yeah, Dad, you really did that." and then my mother, on the other hand, really disliked the book. And as soon as she was done reading it, she still lives in Baltimore, got on a train, came to New York, and sat down at my kitchen table with the manuscript and went over it with me for 5 straight hours.
Wow.
And what she didn't like, and what, you know, what was a surprise to her, and what, you know, it was
that's on stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. So I'm ready for the worst review humanly possible. I've been through it.
You've been through it.
I've been through the worst review possible.
Well, this is like a really alive question for anyone writing memoir, right? I mean, I don't think anyone has the same answer, but do you have a guiding principle when you're writing your own story, but it's also the characterization of other people's lives?
Yeah, I was lucky in that I you know, working with writers like Lacey Johnson and, you know, Nick Flynn or Dorothy Allison, you know, they're very good. They've been through it, so they're able to give me advice.
Right.
Dorothy Allison actually had a really great piece of advice, is that you have to be able to sit in the room with the people you're writing about. So I thought she meant that metaphorically, and then it came to pass.
You really did sit with them.
Yeah. So yeah. I'm actually going to go see her tomorrow in San Francisco. So be able to tell her, like, I didn't think you meant that, you know, like, literally. But yeah, it, you know, I thought that was good advice. And also, I really wanted to be, part of the reason it took me so long to write this book is, like, it was an exercise in empathy for me too. It's like, I really wanted to understand what it was like for my parents at that time. And I think having kids of my own really helped that too. You know, being 6,000 miles from, you know, anyone, any family, and then suddenly you're divorced and, you know, financially dependent on the person you're divorced from, you know, it must have been, you know.
Yeah. And you mentioned the Vivian Gornick book. Were there any actual memoirs that were inspirations, or like ghost memoirs that you feel like you're in conversation with at all?
Yeah, the main one is Stop Time by Frank Conroy from 68. You know, it's kind of a throwback. As it starts in it starts in action when he's much older, and it's just sort of this violent action, and it's just a one-page prologue, and then it flips to his childhood, and you spend 300 pages trying to figure out why that prologue.
Wow.
And it was kind of amazing. And also, it's just beautifully written, and there's no hyperbole to it. Hmm. You know, that I thought that was great, because there have been all these, you know, the running with scissors model of, you know, extreme woe is me. There's no woe is me, even though he had a really messed up childhood.
Yeah, there's definitely not woe is me in all tomorrow's parties either. Yeah. Good. Another motif is which I think is going back to Berlin, when you think of like Berlin being this artistic hotbed, but also this politically unique scenario, that you're always looking for the nexus of those two, of art and politics. And you see that in your other pursuits, like Read Politik column for Guernica, with your work at Penn, with the contemporary African writers, with your work at Vita.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that? What draws you to that specific nexus?
Yeah, I think it's basically to use my privilege and power for good. You know, I'm very lucky that I've risen to a certain position. And even when I didn't have power, I was always trying to figure out a way to affect change, you know, not just write for writing's sake. You know, and I was always trying to figure out how to get my agenda in front of as many people as possible. Like, sort of like early on, when I was freelance writing before I started Tin House, I figured out how to get Leonard Peltier into Vogue magazine. And I did that by writing about Robert Redford financing a documentary about Leonard Peltier. So I went to Vogue and I said, Robert Redford, Robert Redford, Robert Redford, comma, Leonard Peltier. And so they sent up a crew to shoot Redford at his ranch, you know, out in Idaho. And I wrote 2,000 words about Leonard Peltier. So I've always had that impulse of like, trying to get my own, you know, agenda through.
It's also cool how, you know, with the Vita account, and for people who don't know what that is, the tallying of bylines for different publications and by gender, and now also by people of color and other metrics. When those counts came out several years ago, Tin House didn't only respond, but sort of went an extra level of response.
Mm-hmm.
And could you talk a little bit about that in terms of how you looked at the whole manner of how to choose, and then in terms of like the disparity even around submissions too?
Yeah, we actually did really well, relatively speaking, in the first count, but we still had a gender imbalance, and we were all shocked by that. And so we sort of dug into the submission numbers and our rejection numbers, and we found that there were just sort of deep systemic issues, and things like when I reject a female writer and ask for more work, she's half as likely to resubmit as a male writer. Male writers are almost 100% will resubmit, and women only 50%. So I sort of had to double up my efforts with women that I actually really did want to submit, you know.
Right. And wasn't there also an issue that even if you got a woman writer, say for the Lost and Found column about old books, that often the men would be the ones who were getting reviewed by the woman writer?
Yeah. So the Lost and Found column is you can write about any underappreciated or out of print book. And we were soliciting equal numbers of men and women to write about it, but both were picking 80% men. So that's partly historical. If you're talking about out of print books, you know, you're drawing from a pool, but it's your chance to champion, you know, underappreciated women writers if you're a woman, or even if you're a man. So
Right. Now
we specifically ask, you know, are there any women now we're actually doing this specifically for people of color.
Yeah.
You know, or LGBT voices, like are there, you know, kind of lost voices out there or pioneer voices that should be brought back.
Yeah. So. I wanted to ask you also about the origins of Tin House's bicoastal nature, because reading this memoir, I read all of the symbolism into that.
Right.
You come from a divided city, you've created a divided magazine, but also, like, I think about the tension that you describe in the book between Ken Kesey and Hunter S. Thompson.
Right.
And you're also living some of your life, like, out in the mountains, in Colorado, and some of it in New York. And is that all fertile ground for how you came up with a magazine that straddles both coasts?
Wow. That's,
or am I just reaching?
That's really good. That's really good. It wasn't actually, the intentionality was that our publisher, Wynn McCormick, was based mainly here in Portland, and he wanted to start a magazine here in Portland. And I loved the idea, but at the time when we agreed to start the magazine in 98, New York was still sort of the epicenter of literary culture. I mean, it's less so now. I mean, it's a little more divide, you know, it's spread out. But at the time, it really, there were very few agents outside of there. And there was just, I thought there needed to still be a big presence there. So I argued from the start that it should be bicoastal, that I would stay in New York, but I would come back and forth. Because I loved the energy and the no BS of Portland, but I thought we still needed the sort of, you know, the professional, you know, whatever. But right from the start, there was a kind of great energetic split that I loved, because I would bring something that would, you know, one of the New York editors would bring something that was hyped to the Portland people, and they'd be like, yeah, and? You know, it's just like there was
a totally different orientation.
Yeah, there was like, I don't care, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, so there was a little more wide-eyedness and skepticism of things that were hyped, you know, in the literary world.
So now that you're experiencing being on the other side of all of this, you're on book tour, 30 events in 30 days, you're talking about, in a way that's more vulnerable, about specifics of your actual personal life. And your work has been received by both your dad and the critics as that you have created art out of your life. Does this inspire you to do another book?
Eventually. Eventually. I think it would be very, very different. I mean, I could see writing about my experiences with Tin House and all the writers I've worked with. I mean, that kind of thing down the line doing that. But right now, this still feels a little fresh. I'm still trying to figure it out. So,
tell us
a little bit of a shock to actually see it, you know? It's like, wait, it's a thing, you know? So I think when I have a little more distance on it, I'll be able to go back.
What projects are on the horizon for you at the moment?
Well, I'm very involved in, you know, as you said in the introduction, in various nonprofits, particularly Narrative 4 these days, which is a story exchange organization that works with mainly teenagers and putting kids together to exchange stories. And I was recently in Palestine and Israel, and I'm we're having our annual summit in Ireland in 2 months. So that's kind of occupying a lot of my mental spaces doing that. Those kind of things, as well as Tin House.
Right.
You know, Tin House is still, I love my job. I get paid to read for a living. You know, it's ridiculous.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy. And there's still, you know, every issue I get surprised and excited by something. So if I'm not surprised and excited by something or proven wrong, that's why I keep doing the job, is I love to be proven wrong. I love to see something that, oh, you can do that? Like, that's, you know, like a Maggie Nelson comes along and you're like,
right. It's like,
what
wow.
The hell is this? I have no idea what it is, but whatever she's doing, it's working.
Yeah.
Or you see like a Mary Ruefel poem and you're just like, I have no idea how she's making these leaps and I really don't care because it's awesome, you know?
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Well, it was a delight to have you on the show and also to read all Tomorrow's Parties.
Hey, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. We're talking today to Rob Spillman, co-founder of Tin House and the author of the memoir, All Tomorrow's Parties. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
You're listening to KBOO Portland Community Radio. Yeah!
Hey.
Thanks, kids. And finally this morning, we hear a piece from the series Artipus, a weekly radio journey through the world of contemporary art, which aims to make art accessible for people intimidated by art.
Welcome to Artipus, reviews and recommendations of contemporary art around the world. This week, Artipus visits Julian Rosenfeld's Manifesto at Hamburger Hauptbahnhof in Berlin. This is what happens when you're an art professor, I guess. You read manifestos, you teach manifestos, you analyze, memorize manifestos until they're swirling around your head at night when you try to sleep. You go deeper and deeper into manifestos until they become meaningless, like when you repeat a word over and over again. Manifesto, manifesto, manifesto. The German video artist and filmmaker Julian Rosenfeld is also an art professor, teaching at various art academies around Germany. And my guess is he's been teaching the Manifesto, that curious document beloved by artists, philosophers, poets, and politicians, and dictators. The Manifesto, artistic or otherwise, sets forth clearly the views and philosophies, the rules, really, of an ideal society. They are utopian documents, even if they sound, on the surface, negative. They are the way we think things should be, could be, if only our vision were clear enough for everybody to understand. At the Stadtmuseum in Berlin, the former Hamburger Hauptbahnhof, Roosevelt has installed his own manifesto to the manifesto. Extracts of various famous art manifestos, Dadaist, Realist, Futurism, Structurism, to name a few, extracted, reduced, and recombined by Roosevelt to create something sort of new in a series of single-channel video vignettes featuring the actress Kate Blanchett.
Taken place yet. Fluxus is a pain in art's ass.
The gallery where the videos are installed is completely dark. Large, high-def screens are positioned as a foyer, a main salon, and an anteroom, and the gallery is so dark that they seem suspended in space, which is a very cool effect. Each screen plays a video clip of Kate Blanchett manifesting different manifestos, her chameleon qualities lending themselves perfectly to each different scenario. A teacher preparing a class of schoolchildren for their next assignment. A widow giving a speech at a very English-style funeral with very New Orleans-style music. A construction worker going through the grubby drudgery of getting up and reporting for work every day. Each vignette has its own audio, Kate Blanchett in different accents voicing the voice of different manifestos. Only in the introductory film that greets you when you enter the gallery space does the actress use her own voice in her own native Australian accent. Interestingly, this is the only video clip where the actress does not appear. Also interestingly, this is the only video that uses extracts from the Communist Manifesto. You stand in front of the screen, listening and watching Kate Blanchett interpret bits and pieces of the manifestos in that low, soothing voice of hers, regardless of the accent. The images in production are beautiful, hypnotic in their pacing, and you get a bit lulled when, suddenly, Blanchett starts speaking in a high-pitched tone.
Voraciously devouring smoke-belching serpents of factories.
The first time I saw this, I was in the foyer part of the gallery space, cut off from the rest of the videos. I thought Blanchett was just being arty. It wasn't until I entered the main space that I understood what was happening. Rosenfeld has timed each video to run the same length, with the same pacing of performance and delivery, starting quietly, building up in speed and intensity, as manifestos do, until Blanchett is shouting impassioned words from all 13 screens. It's a bit cacophonous. I feel like I'm in the film Being John Malkovich, only this would be Being Kate Blanchett. Or maybe I'm in the head of Julian Rosenfeld after teaching and reading and living and breathing manifestos for who knows how many months. It's a very monkey brain feeling, but someone else's monkey brain, which is a little destabilizing. According to the literature, it's also meant to illustrate women's internal dialogue, which I find at odds with the fact that most of the manifestos Blanchett is interpreting are written by men, but whatever. Just when you can't quite take any more of this, Blanchette changes the pitch of her voice. She's not singing exactly, but rather chanting in a different note. Where this seemed strange and affected in the front room, it makes sense when you are surrounded by Kate. The actress's voice hits a musical tone that is the pure, single sound of the cri de cœur, the manifesto. Taken all together, the piece is really impressive. Each of the 13 vignettes is different, but often references one another of the 13 in subtle ways. Kate Blanchette, the puppeteer, works on a puppet that looks like her character, but that also references the homeless man she portrays in another vignette, for example, tying not only the videos together, but also finding a common thread in all of these manifestos. The vision of Roosevelt to increase the intensity of the experience, to time the videos and tie them all together in one culminating sound is fantastic. I love this idea. But I have notes. I recently saw the writer and poet Kate Tempest on her book tour promoting her new novel. Commenting on the visual aspect of Tempest's writing, the moderator asked her if there would be a film. No, Tempest said. When you read a novel, she explained, you create a picture in your mind, and it's yours. You made that. That's your participation as the reader. When we see a film, the picture is chosen for us, and the participation is no longer active. I agree with her a lot on this point, and it happens to apply quite neatly to Roosevelt's videos here. A conservative mother serves a traditional dinner to her family for the Klaus Oldenburg Manifesto on Pop Art. Klaus Oldenburg, famous for his large-scale replications of everyday suburban objects. A bicycle in a front yard, a piece of cake saved from a birthday party, a giant number two pencil, like those used in American schools. A newscaster dialogues with a reporter in the field, both played by Kate Blanchette, for the Manifesto on Conceptual Art, pinging back and forth with, formal art is essentially rational, isn't that right, Kate? Well, Kate, the concept and idea are different, she responds. A cliched Russian choreographer, demanding and diva-like and sure of her own greatness, barking orders at her dancers, all dressed in silver with giant alien heads, by the way, for the Fluxus Manifesto, the most glam rock of art movements. A funeral scene for the Manifesto on Dadaism, the death of art. A puppeteer who creates a puppet of herself for surrealism. I mean, come on. The newsreader and reporter vignette for the Conceptual Art Manifesto strikes me as especially smug. Like Roosevelt at this point, well, at any of these points, really, is chuckling over his own cleverness. But it's so on the money, they all are, that I think the individual clips are exactly what conceptual art is not, which is literal. Technically, the videos are beautiful. So are the ideas they portray. But by going visual, Roosevelt is dictating how to understand these ideas rather than encouraging participation, which is really the function of a manifesto in the first place. I feel like I'm duty-bound to like this. After all, the whole premise of Artipus is about making art accessible to everyone. And in a classroom, these film clips would be awesome. Clever presentations of the nut of various movements in art in easily digestible audiovisual bites. These film clips are, in essence, very expensive teaching aids. And did it have to be Kate Blanchette? Her presence in the videos sells the show, absolutely. She's a box office draw. And her talent and presence on screen is undeniable. She is a true thespian, able to suppress the real Kate Blanchett, whoever that is, and truly inhabit another character, her distinctive face morphing into whatever world her character lives in. I mean, there's hair and makeup and costuming involved here too, but it's her who brings these characters to life and makes them whole. But did it have to be Kate Blanchette? Would the work have not been funded with a lesser-known actress? Would the work have not been funded with a performance artist instead? This all makes me sound pretty grumpy. I guess I am grumpy. I'm grumpy about the flash and sparkle, the clichés masquerading as deep thoughts, masquerading as art, when it's all just pretentious gimmickry. I'm grumpy because, as a friend pointed out, when celebrities are treated as artists, it shifts focus away from the craft, the grunt work and sweat that goes into making art, that artists have studied and apprenticed and paid for in school, in their practice, in their lives. It directs funding to the shiny and glamorous as though art is nothing more than a romantic hobby instead of an actual vocation. It keeps art as an elevated sideshow, but a sideshow nonetheless, when art has a place on the main stage, if only someone would just move over. Julian Roosevelt's manifesto is on view until July 10th at Hamburger Hauptbahnhof, 50 Invalidenstraße in Berlin. Don't forget to check out and subscribe to Glarify.com, the interactive global mapping tool that lets you locate artist studios, openings, and exhibits around the world. Become part of your local art scene everywhere you go. It's free. Glarify is an official partner of Artipus. Visit Glarify.com. You can download Artipus from SoundCloud and iTunes, and you can see photos and read transcripts of this episode and more at artipus.com. Artipus, pronounced like octopus, because art is everywhere. That's all for Artipus this week. I'm Susie Kolick. See you around town.
Cable Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 2016 Juneteenth Oregon Celebration, Saturday, June 18th. The Clara People's Freedom Trail Parade begins at 10:45 a.m. starting on Northeast 8th in Jarrett, continuing south on Martin Luther King Boulevard and west on Russell. It will end at the Juneteenth Oregon Celebration at Legacy Emanuel Field at Northeast Graham in Vancouver at noon. The celebration will be from noon to 7 p.m. and feature family fun and activities, community vendors, music and other live entertainment, and much, much more. Again, that's the 2016 Juneteenth Oregon Celebration, Saturday, June 18th, with the parade from 10:45 to noon and a celebration from noon to 7 p.m. at Legacy Emanuel Field at Northeast Graham in Vancouver and Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Debtors' Assembly in St. John's, Tuesday, June 21st at 4 p.m. under the bridge at Cathedral Park in Portland. Strike Debt is a nationwide movement of debt resistors fighting for economic justice and democratic freedom. This event also features a Strike Debt Portland potluck.